You're listening to Wake Up Hollywood with Nikki Kalula and Eddie Pence, right here on LA Talk Radio.
Wake up, Hollywood. This is your host of the most, Nikki Kalula. We're going to jump right into another quarantine episode of Wake Up, Hollywood. Chris, how are you? Let's welcome Chris Ward to the studio.
Hey, thank you so much.
This is fun. We just got new graphics, so I was like entranced watching that. I was like, what? What's all that?
How are you, dude? Pretty great.
You and I go way back. I'm just going to give a little backstory. So Chris and I have been singing since we were kids. When did you join the Los Angeles Children's Chorus? Do you remember?
I think it was like 1990, maybe 89, 90.
So it must have been 91 because I don't remember you going to New York. You didn't go to Carnegie Hall.
Yeah, right after that.
So that was 91. Yeah, yes. Dude, that's so crazy. So you must have been 11?
I think so. I was trying to put that together today. I was like, I don't actually remember how old I was.
So I've known you for 30 years, dude.
30 years, basically.
That is crazy.
I think you're one of my oldest friends.
Dude, you know what? Old in many ways, not just in time and duration, but also I'm an old man, dude.
No,
we were roommates on our first European tour. Do you remember that?
I remember that? It was amazing.
You know, that was still one of the best trips of my life. That was such a great hang.
Yeah. And it definitely like set the stage for my life going forward. It was just so much fun. I always wanted to go back. Like I keep wanting to go back. And it was super rad that one time we accidentally ran into each other in Europe. If you remember that.
I do remember that.
Years later.
And you know what? I don't know if I ever told you this, but Phil, one of the, you know, guys that was also in the chorus, so he and I were studying classical voice, and we were doing a concert with the USC Concert Choir, and we take the elevator from this parking lot, and Henry Leck, the conductor of that big concert we did with all of the choruses, he was basically the choral director, I think, of Indianapolis or
something like that, yeah.
And he was conducting Woden Valley from Australia, the Taipei Children's Chorus, us. And then I want to say there was the Illinois choir. Was it just the?
Yeah.
I think it was those four. And so we ran into him and it was just like, oh my God, Henry Leck. And you were like a celebrity to us, you know?
Yeah. Did he remember you?
Totally. Well, I mean, he didn't remember us like individually, but he remembered us. Like we kind of like bombarded him in the elevator. We're like, oh my God, it's Henry Leck. And he was just like, oh my God, who are you? You know, but it was pretty wild, but just because, you know, that trip was in 92 and that was about almost 10 years later. So it was just nuts.
Wow.
Yeah, man.
Yeah. That was a blast and made a lot of good friends on that trip too.
So let's talk first about you. You never stopped singing in choruses, dude.
Basically, yeah. You know, I fell off the bench, you know, like we call it, where you start out as like a little boy soprano, and then your voice changes and you work your way down the bench until you're, you know, a second alto, and then your voice changes and then you're just like, I can't do this anymore. So I took like a few years off there. But once I got back into high school, I was like, you know, I want to do this. So I did a few couple years in high school. And then when I got to college, I was like, you know, this is a great way to meet people and like, you know, find my place here. It was in this big school. It was like a total new
experience. You went to UCLA, right? Didn't you go to UCLA?
Yeah, I went to UCLA. So coming from my little private school that I went to with like 80 people in my class to like 9,000 people, I needed to like find some structure or whatever. And so jumping into that in college, it just felt so right. And I've been kind of sticking with the same sort of program ever since. After UCLA, I joined the Angeles Chorale and they practice in the same room. And at the time they had the same choir director. So it was like just the same sort of system and had some amazing opportunities with that group. And I've been with them since 2003. So yeah, that's about 17 years.
And how many people are in the chorus?
There's about 100.
Watch the corral, right?
Yeah. Well, I don't really make a distinction with those things. Bunch of people who sing and spread COVID-19. So
great.
We've had some great opportunities. We fell into this little niche where we got to do a lot of the trailer music for these big movies that are coming out. Before they have the score settled, they need to actually promote the film and do all these crazy big epic oohs and ahs. So we did all the trailer music for the latter Harry Potter movies and Spider-Man movies. And we did the soundtrack for Batman versus Superman and like really cool stuff. So got to spend some like free time in the recording studio there doing that stuff. And you walk in and you do like 8 hours and you knock out like 16 or 18 tracks. You've never seen it before. So it's like a really good sight reading exercise because, you go from having never seen it to being like recording quality in the matter of a couple hours. Oh, my God.
I was saying hello.
Hey, buddy.
He does this every interview. Hey, I'm doing an interview with Uncle Chris right now.
Right.
That is amazing. And did it take you back to like doing a lot of those kind of recordings when you were a kid?
Totally. In fact, I feel like I have like such a leg up in this industry because I've been doing these things for so long. And like, when we were kids, we were like at the upper echelon of who we were recording with, and Luther Vandross. And, I remember doing Rod Stewart's wedding.
That was crazy, dude. That was
yeah.
Do you remember like the flashing lights? Like for some reason, when he got into the limo, I'd never seen that many like camera light bulbs going off at the same time. And I was just like, this is kind of the most fascinating thing I've ever seen in my life. And it only happened for like 3 seconds. And then he got in the limo, took off. So I thought it was a trip.
And I didn't, I'll be honest, know who Rod Stewart was as like a 11-year-old kid or whatever.
Like, oh my God, this is cool. It's Rod Stewart. Yeah. You're like, who's that?
Right. Exactly. I was that kid. But you could tell who was the like star because of like the hair.
The hair. And just do you remember he had a kid that had the exact same hairstyle?
I forgot about that.
I just remember that Rachel Hunter was the bride, and I don't know how they kept it a secret, but we pulled up to the gig not knowing what the wedding was, and then Mrs. Thompson, Rebecca Thompson, said, "Hey, just want to let you know we're singing for Rod Stewart's wedding," and I think you were the one that you were sitting next to me, like, dude, I think he's marrying a Playboy model. And I was like, seriously? and she came out and talked to us. Do you remember that?
I do. Yeah.
She came out and was like, and I was like, oh my God, this is awesome. Like, and all the guys were like, hey. And then all the girls in our group were like, she's not that cute. That was a crazy experience. And I remember we were behind all the bagpipers. Do you remember that?
Absolutely, I do. Yes, I thought that was
such a trip. I'd never seen that many bagpipers in one place in my life, too. So the whole thing was a trip, man.
One of the things that like really has stuck with me is how weird the feeling is of doing a show like that. That's like so got so much attention on it, all these people, and then the very next day you go to school or you go to work or whatever, and it's like you're just a regular person again all of a sudden.
Right.
And that like dichotomy is really odd. You want to be like, guys, you won't believe it. And then everybody's like, oh, cool. And you're kind of like, no, you don't understand.
Like, well, it's also like, you and I were doing a lot of things with the children's chorus at a time when it was a very vibrant time to be doing that stuff. I mean, we sang with Luther Vandross, like you said. We did Dark Half, one of Stephen King's movies.
Yeah, and I remember that.
Some of those sessions were kind of grueling, but it was so fun. Like, I loved it. I just, like, the only part I hated was just, like, sitting around not doing anything. It was like, man.
Yeah. I especially remember that with the operas, where we would go to rehearsal, and it would, we'd be in this kid's part, so it'd be this tiny little section of the thing. So we just wait around and wait around and wait around. And then all of a sudden it's like, go, go, go. And like insanity and do your thing. And then all of a sudden it's like, okay, now wait for 2 hours or whatever.
You know, but a lot of those memories, I don't have a lot of connections with people that did all those things. Like, we did some crazy stuff with Plaza Domingo. We're doing the LA Opera. I mean, talk about dichotomy. It's like we sang an opera, and then the next day we were going to school taking, like, an algebra test. It was like, what?
Yeah.
Most people like, never really understand it. Well, and you also went to a school where a lot of kids were from the group. So, like, word got around. When I went back to middle school, it was like nothing happened. You know, no, I didn't do that, you know, because it was like I was just trying to make my way just, you know, just to get through school. Because we were out of school for so much, you know. So, but let's talk about, you know, you sang in Walt Disney Hall. You did. What did you do with the Hollywood Bowl?
So I've done a bunch of shows at the Hollywood Bowl. Probably the most interesting one was we've now sort of established ourselves as being Barbara Streisand's sort of backup choir when she's in town.
That's so amazing.
We did her like her farewell performance at the Hollywood Bowl a few years ago, and it was crazy. It was like walking onto a spaceship or something. Like, coming on stage and all the lights and 17,500 people screaming. And we were kind of like in the finale of the piece, you know, where they really pull out all the stops and suddenly there's a big choir behind her and everything like that. And it was a total trip. It was like, I wasn't living my own life there for a moment. It was really, really cool.
Did you get to meet her or like, did she sound check or any of that stuff?
A little bit.
I wouldn't imagine she would have done it.
What's that?
I would have assumed she wouldn't have done any of it. So the fact that she did anything.
Yeah, she did a little bit, and you know, she really is meticulous about her stage performances, so she wants everything to be just right. So but it was so hectic and crazy. In an organized way, but you know how it is, there wasn't a lot of time for, you know, pleasantries or anything like that. It was just like, get in, do your job, make sure everybody does a good job and the audience loves it. And
so did you do a sound check before? Is that how you rehearsed with her?
Yeah. Let's see. We did two shows, a Friday night and a Sunday night. And I remember that it was like 20 degrees. It was so cold, like just bitterly cold. And so we did a rehearsal the weekend before, I believe it was a sound check kind of thing. And she wasn't there for that, but we had, there were a bunch of other performers, that she brings on to be part of the show. Some really talented violinists and other singers and things like that. And then, and they were all there just kind of like get everything together. And then, but that's it. It was just that. And then you're on stage and, I think maybe we did something in the afternoon before the show, the first show on Friday, but not much. That's something I've kind of had to get used to. Is like, you know, when we're kids and as a, like in college choirs and stuff like that, you just rehearse for like months.
Yeah.
And then, but now, you know, I think this is what really distinguishes between the real amateurs or the community choirs and stuff and the professionals. And I kind of have my feet in both worlds.
Right.
The professionals just go 2 weeks for a big show and we're done, or two hours for another for a small show, and that's all I need, you know. And man, you got to be like right on with your sight reading and really just feel confident in yourself. That's the other thing too, is at the Hollywood Bowl, there's no baffles. You're not hearing yourself. It's like it would be like performing without a monitor for you, you know. And so you can't hear anything. So the tendency is to like get nervous and pull back, like, oh no. But if everybody's doing that, then all of a sudden your volume is cut by half.
Right.
So you just have to be so confident and just
charge.
I know what I'm doing and just do it. And I don't care if it sounds like I stick out because I can't hear the people next to me. That's the only reason, you know?
And, wait, so even in a, are you in like a tenor section? Is like, how does it work?
Yeah. And you know, I'm a tenor, so there's never enough of us. So usually the tenor section is like four guys, eight guys, you know, not that many. And for a show like one at the Hollywood Bowl, it would be like a half the choir or something. So there would be four tenors instead of eight or so. And wow. So you might be in a tenor section, but there might be a guy next to you and he might be a tenor two instead of a tenor one. or that we might be staggered vertically, or, you know, you might be next to an alto and a bass, you know, just because the section is so small. So it's not, you can't rely on, you know, the people next to you at all.
And you know what, I think I've talked to you about this, because like, that's the one thing I miss is singing in choruses. I love singing in choruses. That's one of the factors I started a band, because, you know, in doing opera, I didn't get the same feeling from singing opera and doing arias or solos that I got with singing in a group of people. So it's like being in a band, you all work together, and it's very much like working in a chorus, but I didn't get that same feeling doing arias and solos in productions. But
yeah, and it's such a different animal when you decide to go out there. You are all on an island by yourself. And,
right.
You're almost living a completely different, you're almost in a different world, and you're just like 20 feet away, but you're out front. I've done a little bit of that, and it just feels like you have no lifeline, you know, like you're carrying the show.
I want to be rehearsed. Just, I know it's COVID right now, but when it wasn't, how often were you rehearsing?
Once a week, Tuesday nights, and then the occasional weekend here and there to do shows or recording sessions or whatever. But it's not that much of a time commitment, to be honest. And, you know, it doesn't interfere with my work too much. My job is kind of one where I'm working all the time anyway. And so
well, it's a nice release, too. It's nice. You have a creative outlet away from work, too, which is great.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
So what was the piece you sang with Babs?
Oh, you're putting me on the spot. we were doing a medley. So it was, okay. We were jumping from piece to piece, and I honestly can't remember which ones they were. My eyes were this big. Like I was just like flying along. But I remember it coming across really, really well. And they lit off, this is the thing that I remember. They lit off fireworks like from the top of the dome.
Right.
And or from the shell. And so we couldn't see them on stage, but they would light up the audience different colors. So the audience would be all dark. You can't see them at all. And then all of a sudden they'd be bright red or bright green or bright white or whatever. And then it would slowly fade. It was really cool. It was really neat to see.
That is crazy. Yeah. Well, you're tempting me to join this course at some point. So you just stay with it, and I'll just show up one day and be like, yo, man, let's do this.
We would absolutely love to have you. The reason why I've stayed in it for so long is because as with an auditioned choir, it's like there's a bar to get over. And so it allows us to go for more challenging music because everyone is expected to know how to read music and have a pretty good ear and be able to follow kind of directions really well, you know? And so someone with your background would be able to jump in and raise the level of the choir.
I miss that world so much, you know? It's like I've been removed from it, but I mean, I was doing it all through college and stuff. So it's like, once you have that world, when you don't have it around you all the time, you miss it. It's like having warm bodies all around you. And then all of a sudden you're like, oh, you know, so you just kind of move on. But I love singing the chorus. There's nothing better than singing the chorus.
With like 100 people all exactly in time together, working perfectly and in sync. It's pretty amazing. And it's been almost now a full year since I've done any kind of singing, which is totally bizarre for me.
Right.
You know, our season was interrupted by COVID and right before our concert. So we had to cancel that and then cancel all the rest of the stuff. And so it's been really weird. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm sure everybody's kind of like, what do we do now that we can't do this? But let's talk about your career. You've been doing a whole bunch of cool stuff in the architecture world. Tell me, like, you know, I think it was Frank Lloyd Wright that said architecture is frozen music, right?
Yeah.
So there's a lot of parallels between architecture and music. Tell me, like, what drew you to it and what you can find as a parallel between your choral background and working in architecture.
Sure. So I'll tell you the thing that got me interested. Well, I've always been like interested in architecture, and I was kind of like thinking about it early on in college and stuff like that. But it seemed like such a daunting thing. You know, there's so many years of schooling and there's exams you have to pass and all this stuff. And it just seemed like, I don't know if I want to really dive into that. So, but as a history major at UCLA, I took a history of architecture class. And that was the thing that was like, oh my God, all of these buildings I'm learning about are amazing. And so it sort of snowballed from there. And there wasn't an architecture program at UCLA at the time for undergrads. So when I was done, I was kind of like, all right, I think this is something I need to do. And I actually ended up going to the Pasadena City College through almost their entire 2-year architecture program, to kind of get myself, after I graduated from UCLA, just to kind of get myself into that and build a portfolio and really understand what I was getting into and all that stuff. And I loved every minute of it. And so I applied. There was only one place that I wanted to go, and that was Southern California Institute of Architecture in downtown LA. It's called SIARC.
I remember that. I remember when you were going there.
And I was very happy that I was able to get in there. And really, this school is known for being sort of one of the top schools, but not a traditional school. It's sort of it's more focused on design and theory than it is on.
So does it allow you to kind of be a little bit more creative in what you're kind of building? It's not like conventional at all.
It's not very conventional. They expect you to come up with your own sort of game plan and your own, find out your own interests and pursue them. And so like for the thesis that I did, I lived in China for about 4 months. And I did my thesis over there, studying how people in China like buy their food and the communities that revolve around the hutongs and the markets that are in their hutongs, and then comparing that, because these neighborhoods are very small and they're like 1,000 years old and they're super old and really rich in culture and tradition, and how we could, they're not that much bigger than the giantest big box stores that we have.
Right.
And like trying to figure out how we can put those things together and build community here in a way that is much more holistic and beneficial to our communities and our society, rather than just, you know, they're all cookie cutter, exactly the same kind of things. So I was playing with that and that sort of thing. And
fun and fact. The little dragon that you got me from China is actually, it's on my piano.
It's on my
piano. I don't know which side it is. It's either this side or this side, but it's on my piano, man.
Super cool, man. Yeah, rad.
So let me ask you this. So, you know, you started kind of learning avant-garde design. How do you see that you've applied it in this new kind of realm of, you know, you can come up with the craziest designs, but people have to want that in their, whether it's a mansion or whether it's a new design of a building. So how do you kind of pitch this like avant-garde design that you're coming up with, and how do you sell it?
Yeah. Well, so that's a really good point. And I'll tell you the most important thing and the trickiest thing for an architect to do in their job is to not only know what the client says they want, but to know what they actually want if they don't even know that that exists. Or because most people have some idea of buildings. Like we walk around the built environment and we see what's around us, and we form opinions on what we like and what we don't, and that kind of thing. But unless you've really started to research it and read about buildings all over the world or at different time periods and things like that, you have just really a small sliver of understanding of what is possible and also what those things make you feel. So when you go into architecture school, the very first thing that they'll ask you, and it's the same exercise, and I've done this several times, so I kind of know what it is. They always ask you the same question: what is architecture? And it's a more difficult question than it seems, because like, is a garage that you just threw up to put your car in, is that architecture?
Right.
It could be argued, maybe it is, depending, and things like that. And finally, after years of tackling this question and trying to figure out I realized that my answer is architecture is communication through space. So if something is communicating to you and it's delivering a message or it's allowing you to feel something, then that is architecture. So almost like 50% of residential clients will come into an architecture office, at least in LA, and say, I want a Mediterranean style home. And it's just like a cliche. And every architect has to go, okay, so what is it about that that makes you feel a certain way? And what feeling are you going for? And they might say, oh, it's opulent, or oh, it's cozy, or it's grandiose, or it's traditional, or it gives me a sense of history, or, you know, whatever. There's like a million different things that you could feel about that, but you don't have the language yet to really understand how to communicate those feelings. And so our job is to take that we call it the program, take that program from the client, not only what they want to feel about it, but how many bedrooms do they want, and what is their budget, and, you know, the practical stuff, and to put all that stuff together and to present something to them that ticks all the boxes. You do have to make some compromises. There's usually compromises to be made based on budget or zoning code or all kinds of different things. But you really have to try to tick as many of those boxes as you can, or come up with something that if a box is not ticked, why it shouldn't be a part of the thing, or why it's not as important, or what you're doing instead that might be even better, you know, that kind of thing. And it's a really challenging process to do that. It's not a cookie cutter kind of job. And that's what I love about it. It's constantly, like, even just every day, I don't know what's going to be the challenge that I see, you know.
Well, it's going to also evolve. I mean, I kind of think of like architecture is very similar to like making a record in a lot of ways. Like, there are things that you don't know that are going to come that you're not going to see coming, and then you have to adapt and figure out a way to navigate around it. Tell me, like, one of the biggest things, maybe a consistent thing that you deal with, you know, client to client, or just like maybe a certain scenario that you had to navigate and kind of improvise and come up with a new way to execute the idea.
Yeah. You know, one of the things that helps is to have kind of like a framework, rules of thumb to fall back on, and to kind of give you some idea. So the homes that at my current job are large. They're, you know, 10, 20, 30,000 square foot homes. So they're really big, and you can't necessarily approach them the way that you would approach a, 2,500 square foot, single family residence. Like, you might, just sort of like know, well, it's got to have these five things or whatever. And so, but one thing that you can, how you can approach it, and this has helped me kind of wrap my head around the size of these projects a lot, is you're creating scenes. So you want to be able to say, okay, if I was in this space and say I'm outdoors and I want to grill something up, while I'm doing that, I'll want to have drinks around. I'll probably have anywhere from 5 to 10 people over, something like that. That's the size of this area now. And where would I put, what would I want at my fingertips? Would I want ice? Yeah. Maybe I need to have like a little island, a kitchen island, you know, that kind of thing. And you just keep going around. And of course, you're relying heavily on what the client has given you in the program for what they're interested in. A lot of clients are like, I want a bowling alley. And so then you've got to figure out, okay, how am I going to get a bowling alley in and also satisfy the zoning requirements that say you can only have so many cubic yards of dirt removed from the site or moved around on the site and things like that. Does that mean the bowling alley is not underground? Does that mean it's in the middle of the house? It's not out of the realm of possibility. If you do that, then what are the consequences of that? And you imagine them driving up into the driveway, taking their keys out of their hand, walking up to their front door, opening it up. What's the first thing they're going to want to do? Are they going to want to go into their bedroom? when they wake up in the morning and they're getting ready, are they going to want to be able to get to their closet super easy, or, you know, that kind of thing. And you just kind of start to build these scenes, and you have to think about it kind of in those ways. And then your task is, once you've got these kind of ideas together, it has to be cohesive. Otherwise, it's just going to feel totally messed up. And there are a million and one ways to make it cohesive. It can be a visual language. It can be a spatial language. So you've got a bunch of like peaks, for instance, or don't do that, but you know what I mean.
You put a bowling alley outside or all inside the house?
Usually they're inside, because the floor has to be a particular type of wood, and you can't let it get moisture and warp and shrink and all that stuff. So usually they're inside. You know, we've done homes with dance clubs in them, and you know, everything has movie theaters and all that stuff. You know, a couple years ago, IMAX came out with a product for single family homes to have an IMAX theater in your house, and it's got the full projector and everything like that. And so when you know ahead of time that you're dealing with that, if the client says, I need to have an IMAX theater, then you know, okay, well, here are the specs for it. This is the size of the projector room. This is the clearances around it. Okay, we're going to have this much room. There's going to be this much power output input we're going to need to have, not only, you know, three-phase power, but we're going to have a beefier generator and all kinds of stuff for when it goes down. And, you know, all of that stuff. And we're going to need to have cooling and ductwork. It all sort of like, once you figure out the little scene, it all starts to kind of like come together. And then, you know, it's just a giant jigsaw puzzle. It's quite a challenge, but we work on them for years. Like, it's extremely rare for a house of this size to get built by anyone in less than 3 years. 3 years is probably pretty fast. But you know, most of the time the clients, they want it to be right. And a lot of times this is like their dream home and the one that they really see themselves living in for the foreseeable future. And so you kind of communicate that to them early on. Like, we're starting right now, but we'll probably have you be able to move in 4 years or 5 years or something like that. And most of the clients are on board with that. They're kind of like, okay, that's I understand.
That's crazy. So do they already have a house that's there, and then you demolish the house, or are you building on nothing most of the time?
There's a mixture of stuff. But I will say that, generally speaking, where these homes get built are in neighborhoods where the value of the actual structure on the property is not as high as the property itself. So we end up demolishing like a 1980s Miami Vice style house to put up something, you know, that's now. And it doesn't make you cry to lose those things. Cause I'll say that a lot of the architecture in those neighborhoods gets done in a very large, cheap way. Right. And they're just maximizing the space. And I'm very, very fortunate to work for a company that just really doesn't buy into that. Like, everything we do is the best. It's the best construction. We That's work awesome. With the best contractors and the best materials. And, you know, we have like actual stonemasons going out and like carving stuff into the house. And, you know, it's like, it's not a slapdash thing. So I'm proud of the things that we end up putting in place and that kind of thing. But it is really kind of a weird, like, numbers game when you start thinking about the values of the property versus the house. I remember we worked on, this was at my old job. I used to work as a historic preservation architect, and, there's this really famous Green and Green home. Do you know the Gamble House? It's in Pasadena.
Yeah, totally.
Those same architects, they did a house in Beverly Hills. And it was on a sort of property that was like a promontory point as two streets come together, this big pointed grassy property. And it was like this little gem of a house. It was enormous. It was the biggest house they've ever done. But even so, on the property, it was small. And the owners of the house loved it, and they knew the provenance of it. It was eligible to be on the National Register of Historic Places. Like, it was a really big deal house. But the problem was, the value of the property was about $12 million with the house and about $18 million without the house. So wow. In other words, if the current owners had demolished the house, they would have gotten $6 million more dollars for the property than what they had. But of course, they were completely unwilling to do that. So what ended up happening is we came in and we picked up the house and we moved it like a mile away and put it on a different property. And that was literally the only way to save the house. You know, we're working from a historic preservation perspective. The only way to save the house was to do that. It was going to get demolished. Because even if it was actually a pretty good deal for someone to come in and buy the property at $12 million and then immediately demolish the house and then immediately sell it, because they'd make $6 million like overnight. And so we were like racing against the clock to try to find properties that we could put this house on and where it would fit. You know, it was not originally on this triangular site. It was actually moved back in the 1920s even to that site. So it had been moved around. But anyway, it was super crazy. And that's the kind of like dollar figures that you have to start thinking about, because just the house itself is not necessarily the thing that is valuable unless you make something that is built to last and that is really something that people love. So anyway.
What a trip. Yeah. And I saw you did something for Frank Gehry. What did you do for Frank Gehry?
Yeah. Oh man, this was such a fun project. So Frank Gehry kind of got onto the architecture scene in 1979 when he did his own house. And it was a bizarre house for the time. It had like chain link fence coming off of it and like a big weird glass cube and just like studs inside instead of walls. He just left them bare. And he was like pushing the envelope of what deconstructivism could be. And he was kind of coining the term at the time. And it took the world by storm and it made his career. And he lived in that house until about 2010, I think it was. I'm generalizing. I can't remember exactly when it was, but and he actually stayed there that whole time. And finally, he decided there was a house available for him to buy on this one street that he absolutely loved, and he'd always wanted to live there. And he was just turning 80, I believe. And he's like, you know what? I'm gonna buy this house, and I'm gonna move for the first time since 1979. Wow. And so he bought the house, but it was eligible for the National Register of Historic Places. It wasn't listed or anything, but it was actually not the national, the state. So it was more local. And so we kind of he hired us as a historic preservation firm to
first. That's a huge compliment for Frank.
It was a big honor. Yeah, it was a big honor. And I was really excited about it. And luckily, I got to be put on it. And so I worked on that project fairly extensively. And we were basically doing a historic structures report where I researched the crap out of this house that was sitting there on this lot that he just bought. And, you know, I had to find like old historic photographs of it and figure out how long it had been there and all kinds of stuff like that. So Frank loved the house. He knew he wanted to do something to it. And the house had kind of a front section that was really original, but the rest of it had all been done in like the 80s. And so it had this big extra addition in the back that was kind of like, oh God, it was pretty awful.
What made him What made him love the house then?
The front section had this door that was like the gem of the house. Okay. The rest of it was a little bit plain, but it had this stone carved, hand carved door surround that was around the front door. And it was really striking. You would drive by it maybe 100 times and not necessarily notice it. But if you did notice it, you would think, oh, that's super cool, actually. And clearly someone took a lot of time to really make that wonderful back in 1902 or 1908 or whatever it was. So we gave Frank this historic structures report and we sort of said, this is what the home is. It's this is its historic value. And he took it to the city, and the city said, and he said, I will keep the front of the house. I'll work on the back. I'll do something in the back. And the city kind of said, you know what? Anything that Frank Gehry does is going to be far more historically significant than what this house is. So in a complete reversal to what we normally deal with, they were like, just do whatever you want. What's super cool is Frank managed to take that surround and save it and pull it out to the front of the property. And it's now the front gate of the property. And then he built his house kind of up behind. And so it's still the thing that you see as you're driving by, and you can still appreciate it and really understand the place of that. You know,
he did Disney Hall, right?
Yeah, he did Disney Hall. So it was quite a different sort of look for him. And he did his thing to his house. I mean, it's wild looking. He's kind of like, I think of him as being maybe the biggest architect in the world right now.
Right.
He has a reputation for being really demanding, but he and people have been sort of like, oh my God, this is scary kind of thing. But he was super sweet to all of us, and he was willing to give of his time. And I was really happy to work with him. He was a neat guy.
Dude, that's like a chance, like once in a lifetime, dude.
Yeah. I remember seeing a photograph of the Bilbao Guggenheim Museum in Bilbao. And it was just a single photograph in a book way before I'd ever studied architecture or anything. And I saw that one photograph and I just thought, how is this possible? I have to know more about this. And to then, you know, 20 years later, be able to work with the guy who did it is really
on his house.
On his house, yeah.
That's wild. That is wild. And, you know, I remember they did an exhibit. Where do they do the exhibit? A Frank Gehry exhibit. I don't know if you told me about it or if it was at LACMA. I think it was at LACMA.
Yeah, at LACMA.
And they showed all of his projects, everything that he's done, and showed all the blueprints and everything. And I remember going to that and just being blown away by the whole thing. But yeah, Disney Hall definitely was like I've always loved that building for all of the, you know, what it represents and just like how great it is for the city. Yeah. But seeing the blueprints made me really, really, really love that building. You know, yeah, all the designs and all the specs. It was just incredible.
And he has such a unique process too. He literally starts with paper, and he'll just crumple up paper in a million different ways, and he'll just be like looking at it because he thinks of it as being like the ultimate thinking outside the box kind of thing. There's no worries about is it going to stand up, or you know what's going to happen to it, what the practicalities of it are at that stage, and then he'll find a view of it and he'll do these little sketches, just these crazy, they look exactly like scribbles to you and me, but they're meaningful to him. And then he can take that to his design team and they can sit down and they can start to plan something and say, all right, let's see how we can approach this, you know? And it goes from that to being like a $1 billion high rise or whatever. And it's really interesting. Talk about really like breaking down the creative process to its barest minimum. It's really neat.
I have to ask you, because he is kind of like the Mozart of architecture that's living right now.
Yeah, like, yeah.
Michael Jordan, you know, did you get to ask him any kind of like concepts or like philosophies or anything that was outside of the project, just to, you know, maybe words of inspiration or whatever?
You know what? I'm going to tell you an embarrassing story. This is not really answering your question.
Because we're friends, man. We need those.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. So, my boss and I were going up to his property to have a meeting with him, and we were in her Prius. This is a part of the story, actually, and we had transferred a bunch of files and things from the office into the Prius. We knew we were going to be taking that car, so her husband had driven up and dropped it off. This is all part of the story, and then we hopped in the car and we drove all the way across the city to get to his property. And we pulled in and, you know, just, you know, on time, a few minutes before the meeting, pulled into the driveway, parked, and we got out, and my boss was like, oh, I can't seem to find the key to the car. Will you check around? It's probably fallen in some crack someplace, and then join me in a few minutes once you find it. I need to get in, you know? So, I was like, sure. And I looked around. I just couldn't find the key anywhere. And so I couldn't even lock the car. It just closed it up and went inside. We had our meeting, and we came back out with Frank and his son. And we realized that, like, that we don't have the key to his car, and it was, or to key to our car. So it was not a big deal. We just asked him, can we, you know, while we're going to see if we can try to find the key. And he's like, oh, actually, that car that you're behind that's blocked in the driveway, that's my car, and I need to go. And so it was like, oh my God, we just blocked Frank Gehry into his own driveway. And like, my boss and I looked at each other like, oh God.
How did you lose the key? Who lost the key? Your boss?
So here's what happened. And I did not know this about Priuses. Her husband still had the key in his pocket back across on the other side of the city. And apparently, if you don't turn it off, you can just hop into a Prius and just keep driving away without the key. As long as it was already running, yeah, you could just go. Because it's not something you stick in and turn or anything like that. It just needs to be in the car while you start it. But so we drove all the way across the city without the key. And so once I realized that, I like backed away from the conversation and I let them sort of talk. And I called her husband, and he drove all the way up to drop off the key. And we got to sit, and Frank was a totally nice guy. That was the thing that blew me away. He was like, it's no big deal. I'm just hanging out. Let's sit and talk. And so we sat and talked with Frank for like 45 minutes, just about everything under
that's
the sun.
Amazing, dude. Yeah, you were like, thank God he lost that key.
And then so I saw her husband like out of the corner of my eye in his car down the road, and I just slowly, like, nonchalantly backed up, and I literally just walked out and reached my arm back, and he drove up and he dropped the key in my hand and drove off, and I walked up and I'm like, okay, yeah, we're all set to go. And Frank was like, oh cool, all right.
That's some serious adapting. You're like, how can I make this into the perfect situation? Right, but that's amazing. You still got to hang with them, dude. It's like, you know, few architects get the chance to hang with the Michael Jordan of architects that's living. You know what I mean?
Yes. It was obviously one of the things that I remember. I still tell that story because it was kind of embarrassing, but also really cool. It ended up really cool.
So what about Frank Lloyd Wright? Where is he as far as your inspiration?
Oh, I think he's the greatest. I think he's amazing. I recognize that he has a couple of faults. One is his personality. He was really difficult. And two, his buildings are saggy and leaky and, you know, that kind of thing. But that's not really what he was doing. You know, he wasn't trying to be a structural engineer. He could have done better at it, but he was pushing the envelope. And I actually had an opportunity to work on one of his homes in Los Angeles. And it was for historic preservation stuff. This was back in my historic preservation days. And it was really inspiring to walk into this home. It's not well known. It's just one of the many that he did in Los Angeles. And to know that, like, every little corner, there was like a detail, there was something that was unique. And again, thinking completely outside of the box, he really abhorred sort of convention. So if there was a way that he could make something special, he would do it everywhere. It didn't matter if it was a door frame or a balcony or a roof or whatever, he would find a way to make it special. And it's a thrill of a lifetime to work on one of his homes, because every little piece is custom and unique, and you know, that kind of thing. We have this sort of idea in Western culture of like every splinter is sacred. And so in historic preservation in the Western world, we really take that to heart, and we try to save every single scrap of wood that we can. If it's rotted out, we don't just make another one. We find a way to fill in the rot, keep it from advancing, and put it back, you know? And one of the things I learned working on the Japanese house at the Huntington Gardens is that that's not actually a pervasive idea. That's not something that exists everywhere in the world.
Right.
In a lot of places in Asia, they don't think of it that way.
It's finite.
They're much more interested about the craft rather than you know, the piece itself. Piece itself is just a thing, and you can make a copy of it, and that copy is just as valuable as the original. Like they just think about things differently. So when we approached that project, the very first thing we had to do was figure out which approach are we going to do. You know, this is a Japanese house. It was done in theoretically a traditional Japanese style of construction. Should we follow a traditional Japanese style of restoration, which would be getting these craftspeople in to recreate it in a way that is accurate and furthers the craft of home building? Or do we go with the Western style, which is, you know, save every little splinter and bag it and tag it, you know, and that kind of thing? And we finally came to the conclusion after talking with the Huntington and all kinds of people that this home was originally built as a Western idea of what traditional Japanese architecture was. So we kind of went with the Western style of preservation. And so if you go to the Huntington
Gardens, like, let's make this American.
yeah, exactly. Damn it. And so we did that. And so that is the home that's still standing. So
that's awesome.
It's meaningful to us, you know.
I have to ask you too, you know, you've traveled a lot. We've done some traveling together. Out of all the places that you've seen architecturally, what is the most fascinating structure you've been in?
Sure. One jumps to mind, and I can tell you this relates back to your question about music. So I went to Finland a few years ago, and there's a Finnish architect, the most famous Finnish architect. His name is Alvar Aalto, and
Did he finish a lot of his projects?
He finished a lot of his projects. And he did this structure called Finlandia Hall, and it's there in Helsinki. And it's up on a bluff overlooking the big city park and the city skyline and everything. It's like this gleaming jewel on the bluff in the city. And I went to Helsinki, not, you know, for architecture. So I wasn't super prepared, but I knew people had said, oh, you've got to see Finlandia Hall. You'll love it. So I went over there, and I was kind of like, I walked to it, kind of from the backside. And as I approached, the more I saw, the more my jaw dropped. And there was a fluidity about it. It was done in like 1962 or something like that. So it has a little bit of a mid-century feel to it. It's all white, so it kind of feels like international style as well. And so it's, actually I think it was the late 50s. I said that wrong, but anyway. And it just kept, every little moment that I would see was more interesting and more interesting until I got completely around to the outside of the building, and I was in the park and I was looking up at it on the hill. And I was thinking, this building has such a wonderful rhythm to it. It's got these different parts that kind of, they feel like they're the same language, but they're different from each other. And it's got this soaring sort of bit in the middle that almost looks like the Walt Disney Concert Hall, even though it was, you know, 60 years earlier or whatever it was. And I was just really thinking, like, this building is almost symphonic. Like, that's the horn section, and that's the timpani section, and so on and so forth. And then I was like, oh my God, what am I talking about? This is a concert hall. And wow. I didn't put two and two together right away. And it was when I did that I realized, like, this is genius architecture. The fact that I can come to that conclusion without any preconceived notion about what it's supposed to be,
right,
that I can see it as musical before I even know or remember what it is, that blew me away. I was like, oh my God, this guy is a genius. And I absolutely love that building. I think it's one of the best pieces of architecture in the world.
That's awesome. So, I have to go see that now.
Yeah, it's super cool. At the very least, look up pictures of it. It's gorgeous and it's very well kept. It's still used today as their main symphonic hall and concert venues. Like, there were all these rad posters for different bands that were coming to Helsinki that were going to be performing in Finlandia Hall and stuff like that. So they have rock concerts there, and they have orchestral and opera and all kinds of stuff. It's a neat place. It was unfortunately all locked up the day that I had to go there, and so I didn't get to go inside. But I need to go back to Finland to see it. So yeah.
For me, it would probably be the Taj Mahal. I think there's something
unreal
about that. Just especially because they didn't have the tools that they do today. And I still, to this day, haven't seen anything that kind of like mirrors the sheer beauty of what it is. I mean, the whole thing's marble, and you see all the stones, and there are these like, you know, there's no air conditioning or anything, you know, in the building. But one of the coolest things I remember seeing was there was this wall that had like this big design of like almost like cookie cutter parts of the wall missing. And you'd stand in front of it and you'd feel like this gush of air. It was, wow. It was the craziest. I just remember thinking, this place is beautiful on the outside and mesmerizing. And then on the inside, there were all these things about it that were so peculiar and just amazing. Yeah, so like for me, it's the Taj Mahal, and I think the place I would love to see is the Red Square. I really want to see that structure because it's just like it looks like a cartoon. I mean, it's just like you know, it's like things that have like that kind of like loud sense of design, color, or vibe. You know, I definitely there's something about those structures that kind of take me away. And I'm not even into architecture, but I mean, I just marvel at it because it's like. It really shows you like how much we as a humanity can create. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it's the kind of thing that we need to look back on, because these are the kinds of technologies that we absolutely have to put in our buildings now. Like there's no option. You have to use passive ventilation in places now. And there are architects who are doing full high rises that have passive ventilation so that they can lower their carbon footprint and things like that. We're not going to be able to sustain the society that we have the way that it's going. It's just there's just no way to do it. So the fact that that they were able to do that back then means that we absolutely should be able to do that now.
Yeah, and you think of the stuff like the pyramids, like how those were kind of designed and created. It's like, what? I don't even think we could create that on that level now. You know what I mean? So.
Yeah, it's
just crazy. It's crazy. So I love that your fascination has kind of like pushed you in so many directions. And, you know, one day I'm going to have to commission you to build the gingerbread house of my dreams, my man. I'm going to say, Chris, I want a gingerbread house the size of my dreams.
I love gingerbread houses, and I love jack-o'-lanterns and carving pumpkins. So, yeah, I'm totally down with all of that stuff. So,
well, dude, we have to grab lunch. And I think this goes down as the longest serious conversation we've ever had. And
I apologize.
No. This was a fascinating interview. You know, it's funny. It's like some of my favorite interviews that I've ever done are from people that I've known the longest. And it usually ends up opening a part of our relationship that I didn't know that we had, you know. And it's like so awesome. Like, I knew you were doing all this, and we've met for lunch, and you've kept me up to date. But interviewing you like this, man, what a huge breadth of just like knowledge and just experience that you garnered, you know, from all of this. So, man, kudos to you, my man.
Thanks so much for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Of course. And please send my love to your family. I love your family.
I will. You too.
And let's definitely meet up for lunch. I'm holding you to it. It's on camera. So going to lunch at some point when the world kind of calms down a little bit. But I love you, man. Dude, thank you for doing Wake Up Hollywood. And we'll see you. We'll have to catch up sooner than later, man. Happy holidays.
Awesome. Thank you so much. You too. Happy holidays. Stay safe.
All right, man. I'm going to have you back too. So don't think this is the end, okay?
All right.
All right, man. All right. Be good.